much. It's very nice.
Is the microphone?
Is it gonna be like a little music?
My,
oh, that's a mic. I don't know, it's people, you're people.
No, but it's.
Oh, it's for the recording.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, yes, this is my fault.
So, I mean, you could.
So I have to like put that somewhere.
Very, very good.
Cool.
And this thing.
Don't you like that you wear an extra belt when you have your backpack?
Yeah, I think it's because it's really close.
All right, yeah. It's funny, I was thinking this morning, I came here because I was the external examiner on a thesis defense, Ms. Zwane, I guess now effectively Dr. Zwane. And a lot of it, this was a thesis in causal sets, and in part comparing causal set models to all kinds of cosmological data. And I was thinking this morning how generations of you, not some of us in this room, but generations of physicists have grown up with the idea that, yeah, microwave anisotropies have been detected. And in fact, we know all this like fine structure about microwave anisotropies. And when I did my thesis, which I finished in 1984, it was a theoretical cosmology thesis about microwave anisotropies, but they had not yet been detected. And indeed, it was a while, maybe like another 6 years or something, before the anisotropies were detected. And it just struck me as interesting. Like, you hear about people who are 100 years old, and you think about the changes in the world, like cars and telephones and cell phones and all these things. And this is kind of a different way of thinking about the different mentality of growing up that most of you have grown up just knowing about all this stuff. Well, so the physics I want to talk about is early universe physics, predates, I guess that's the right word, microwave anisotropies, but possibly may have some implications for those. The talk was called something like evolution. Of black holes in inflation. And this reference is actually, most of what I'm going to talk about is reference to, which that's not WIMP, it's work in progress. So this has not yet been posted yet, although the previous article that I did with David Castor and Ruth Gregory just came out in the archive a little bit ago. And the two articles are kind of a package. So we've been studying black holes in the context of slow roll inflation. And this is part of I hesitate to say research program because that sounds so organized, but a set of questions I've been thinking about for many years. I understand that you had some cosmology workshop or conference here recently in which people were trying to not argue too vehemently about bouncing universes and other things about the very early moments of our universe or other universes. And I've been thinking, one of the things that I would like to understand is, this is much more humble aspect of possibly very early universe physics, is the role that black holes play in a very hot early universe. Because black holes in a hot plasma or whatever, however you think of the matter at these early times, have interesting dynamical roles. On the one hand, stuff is accreted into the black hole absorbs. That's one hand. The other hand, we expect the black holes undergo Hawking radiation. And if the expansion rates are fast, then these processes can be happening at competing timescales. And I started wondering, if, for example, there could be a balance between absorption by the black hole, expansion of the universe, and Hawking radiation. No, maybe not. But at least amongst the different things that we speculate about in terms of very early universe physics and what is the real description of the Big Bang, we know that black holes exist. As sure as theoreticians can say things, we know that black holes exist. We know that the universe, there's a hot Big Bang model for the universe. So these two things are on relatively strong theoretical foundations, these two concepts. And it's interesting to see how they interact with each other, how that physics actually plays out. Of course, it's a hard problem. It's a very hard problem for the reason I just described. Same reason why it's very interesting, it's very hard. It's dynamical, and you have classical processes going on, you have quantum processes going on. So in a humble way, I decided to start small. And the first thing that I want to start with just talking about the static Schwarzschild de Sitter solution. And we're going to move from there to looking at slow roll inflation, which is kind of a next dynamical step from the static known analytic solutions. I think of slow roll inflation, but with a black hole, as a kind of mildly dynamical situation. Things are changing slowly, and we can actually do calculations. It's a nice self-contained system. Everything I'm going to talk about will be classical. The scalar field is classical. The space-time is classical. But that in itself turns out to be interesting, or I hope I can convince you that it's interesting. And it's a first analytical step away from the known Schwarzschild de Sitter solution, which has been known for quite a while. I forget when. So that's what my goal is, and I tried to give you some motivation. I think I've had this idea, and I don't think I'm the only theoretician who has this kind of picture about how black holes would evolve in an inflationary universe, or indeed in a more usual Robertson-Walker universe. I don't know if that's more usual or less usual. In a Robertson-Walker universe with some fluid, cosmic fluid description, that the black holes accrete matter, of course, but there's also the actually, I'm not going to talk about Hawking radiation, so stop saying it. Black holes accrete matter. If you're in a cosmology, there may be a cosmological horizon. And the black holes evolve in such a way so that at each time we can, of course, talk about the area of the black hole horizon. But we also have a notion of temperature, or at least people talk about it. So one of the things that I'd like to investigate is whether this notion of a quasi-statically evolving space-time, which we picture, I picture, as approximately Schwarzschild de Sitter at each time step, is that true? So the basic analytical and physics goal of this calculation is to study whether there actually is a quasi-static evolution of a black hole in inflation when treated in a perturbative and slow roll approximation. And the answer to that question is going to be yes. And the output of the calculation, in a sense, the most concrete thing is we'll compute the instantaneous rate of change of the area of the black hole horizon and of the cosmological horizon. And you can integrate that up to get the total change in the areas. Okay, so first, let's review static Schwarzschild de Sitter. And this will set the vocabulary and the fundamental geometrical quantities that then we want to see how they evolve. So static Schwarzschild de Sitter, the metric has this familiar form. Let me just ask or take a poll. How many people, I'll write it down. How many people, to whom is it? Is this familiar? It's to the point of being boring. Hi, Ted. It's funny, I tried to take those descriptive adjectives out of my lecturing since I've been teaching, because I've discovered that things that are simple to person A might not be simple to person B, or familiar or unfamiliar. But anyways, we're in this situation. F can be written in various ways. And the picture, in these static coordinates, I'm going to be interested in the part of Schwarzschild de Sitter in which R is a space-like and T is a time-like coordinate. We have the black hole horizon. We have the cosmological horizon. And they each have an area. And in these coordinates, the area of the black hole horizon is 4 pi times its radius square, which I'll write as R sub b. And the cosmological is 4 pi times the radius R sub c squared. Now, I haven't defined RB and RC, so let me do that. You can equally well write this in terms of the roots of the function f of r. So for appropriate choices of the positive, I'm taking m and lambda are positive, we're talking about the sitter. For appropriate relationships between them, you have one negative root and two positive roots. And by you can write down the relationship between m lambda and the radii. I won't bother to write them here. Okay. So one likes to go back and forth between these different set of parameters, although keep in mind that this is only a two-parameter family. And the way I wrote it in the first line, m and lambda are two parameters. You could use the two radii alternatively as the two parameters. The way that I'm going to think of the parameterization for purposes of a black hole and inflation is to choose, I mean, so this is just mentally, or if you actually wanted to set it up as an initial value problem, lambda, because that's going to be dictated to us by a potential. We're going to choose the potential that you're interested in. And, for example, an initial black hole radius. So I'll be thinking about the two parameters in that sense. And then each of these horizons also has a surface gravity. There's a surface gravity for the cosmological. There's a surface gravity for the black hole horizon. And in terms of stuff that's already on the board, the surface gravity is the derivative of f at the horizon radius. Because of the way the function f goes, the surface gravity for the cosmological horizon is negative, and for the black hole horizon is positive. If we talk about a temperature, then I always talk about a temperature that's proportional to the absolute value of the surface gravity. So the temperature I like to think of as positive. So those are familiar geometric variables. A perhaps less familiar geometric variable is what I call the thermodynamic volume. And I think what I'll define the thermodynamic volume by writing down the first law for this situation in the following form. Well, there's actually two first laws. And this is in the work I did with Rob. Yeah. In proving a first law, which I like to think about as a relationship between a horizon and some other boundary, typically infinity, you can start at the black hole horizon and go up to, well, in de Sitter, it's future infinity, which is high. Or you could start at the other horizon, the cosmological horizon, and go up to the future. Suppose we started at the black hole horizon, then we get a first law in familiar form. Oh, I'm gonna have to think about the sign. If you imagine varying lambda and ask how much does the mass change at fixed entropy or fixed black hole entropy, fixed area, so you might not like the physical picture behind that question, but I'm just saying this is a well-defined math question. You ask how much the mass changes when you change lambda at fixed area. The way that we think, the way that one can think of this in terms of thermodynamics is lambda is a minus pressure. And then there's a volume. So this becomes plus V delta P, which is as if you write the first law in classical thermo in terms of an enthalpy rather than in terms of the internal energy, then instead of having minus P dV, you have plus V dP because you brought the other term the other side. So I have to go through that argument to get the signs.
Well, do we have too much by asking what you actually mean by mass in this context?
I just mean, I'm not going to divert that question because so it's the same answer to here. It's an ADM charge that's defined at, in this case, future infinity, and it's associated with a static killing field, which.
Well, there won't be one once you're very light.
No, that's not true. The first law construction is based on the symmetries of the background space-time, and the perturbations don't have to hold the symmetries of the background.
Sorry, if we're varying, I guess it might depend on, again, feel free to divert, that if you're changing lambda, you're changing the asymptotics, so you no longer have any asymptotics. If you don't vary lightly, and then I know what you're talking about. If you don't, then I'm not exactly sure.
No, you compare, you could take two analytic solutions to check this. So take two Schwarzschild de Sitter solutions with different values of m and lambda and subtract, do these different subtractions, and that's what you find. So I don't want to get off on this. This paper, we do that. I put this on the board to define the black hole thermodynamic volume. If you do something similar for the de Sitter horizon, the cosmological horizon, then subtract the two, the mass drops out. Or equivalently, you can do a construction just between these two horizons. And that's really the cleanest way to think about it. To get the definition of this volume, it's easier to state it in terms of the change in the mass. So the form of the first law that I want to focus on is if you did a construction between the inner horizon and the outer horizon, the black hole and the cosmological horizon, and you can perfectly well do that, that construction between the two horizons based on the time translation killing field. And what you get is that there's a temperature delta area term for each horizon. And so this is like TD entropy. And what that's equal to is minus the thermodynamic volume delta lambda. Let me just check that.
Sorry?
I'm
a little confused when you write first law because in this. So I have back of my mind, if I have the black hole and write it, then I have like a good prescription what temperature means. I think maybe I do Hawking temperature. But in this case, like this seems like you have two different temperatures. The system is not in thermodynamical equilibrium. Or if I did like some response calculation to see what the detector measures at the temperature.
Great points. So first, let me say, the status of this, if you don't want to call it a first law, I don't really care what you call it. The status of this relationship is a theorem that you prove by just playing around with the perturbed constraint equations and the background equations. And it's based on having a killing spree. So you get this relation. And kappa, I just erased the definition, but that's defined in classical terms, which is the surface gravity. So everything there, classical, I guess I could write, I haven't actually written down what the thermodynamic volume is, and I'm not going to because I don't want this talk to only be about the thermodynamic volume, but I mean, in terms of the general definition. But for Schwarzschild de Sitter, this thermodynamic volume just comes out to be what someone would write down in geometry if they were doing a Euclidean volume between two Euclidean spheres. So it's a Euclidean volume of the cosmological sphere minus the Euclidean volume of the black hole sphere. And that's what it comes out to be. So this is a, you know, if you like, a theorem that you prove purely by classical means. On the other hand, oh, I was going to draw a picture for you, and then I'll come back to the other hand. It is more complicated, which is why this system is interesting, or one of the reasons why it's interesting, because you have two temperatures and two entropies. Now, to me, it's still an open question whether you want to think of these as entropies, and I'm not going to really talk about that now, but there's certainly been work, and I think Rob Mann and probably other people in this room have done work in terms of instanton type calculations in which the rate comes out to be proportional to the sum of the two areas. So there's a certain amount of evidence that we should think about the sum of the two areas as the total entropy. Stuff going back to Hartle and Hawking, other illustrious authors. So I'm going to interchangeably talk about, say, area or entropy. But area is fine. I can stick to area if you prefer. But yes, we have two different temperatures and two areas. I'm just going to draw a picture for what this looks like. I'm drawing the black hole radius, and I'm only going to be talking about black holes that are up to the cosmological size. I'm not going to say anything about black holes that are bigger than the cosmological horizon. So if you draw a picture of these things,
I'm sorry, why are we not going to?
Because this is enough to talk about.
Well, I mean, it sounds like something qualitatively changes.
I'd have to start the calculation over in a different set of coordinates. Because I wouldn't choose these, well, I haven't told you what coordinates I'm going to use, but I wouldn't use the set of coordinates that I've set it up in to do in which R is a time-like, and you know, then I would want to go to some kind of more cosmological McVitie-looking coordinates, which I think would be a good thing to do, but that's not what we've done. Okay. So the total area, the area is biggest for a very small black hole. The total area is biggest for a very small black hole. I mean, it's not the most exciting curve, but there it is. For the temperatures, the de Sitter temperature, when the two horizons meet, the de Sitter, that's not supposed to be sloping down. It's just, so this is the cosmological temperature and the black hole temperature diverges when the black hole is very small. That's just what we're used to for lambda equals zero. And then the two temperatures go to zero. I haven't been careful about how I draw them going to zero, so please don't ask me about that. But they both go to zero. So one of the points of this picture is to get back to this question that the temperatures are different. So in terms of thermodynamics, this is already a little more complicated or interesting that we have these two temperatures. There's one other thing I wanted to say before I get to the guts of the talk, that you can also, one future direction is larger black holes, we'd have to redo the calculation. Another thing is that if you have spin also on these black holes, they're interesting. So now you can have mass. I'm going to just put the charge equal to zero, although one can one can add charge. So this is still the static or stationary case that, you know, I'll just draw a picture here. So here's the cosmological horizon, and here's the black hole horizon. So I'm trying to draw the black hole a little flattened because that's where you embed it. It looks a little flattened due to the spin. This configuration has some total area. If you fix lambda and A instead of M, I'm actually going to swap M for the thermodynamic volume. Now, why am I doing that? This gets back to, sorry.
Rob Mann.
No. This is back to previously asked question. I like to think about the thermodynamic volume because I personally find the mass and the sitter a little confusing. Or at least you don't know it until you get to future infinity. Now, you can argue that you don't know the mass mass defined in at spatial infinity out that way until you get to spatial infinity. But that's on a different status than having to know the whole evolution of the space-time. So from the point of view of stuff that's actually observable within our sector of the observable universe, that's what I like to think about the horizon areas and the thermodynamic volume. So if you fix lambda and A, you can have two black hole configurations with different thermodynamic volumes with the same A total. Let's see, did I draw this? No, of course I'm drawing it the wrong way. And that if the black hole area goes in a little bit, then the cosmological horizon goes out a little bit. So that was the isentropic and the isentropic phase transitions that you can, once you had spin, you can have different distinct geometrical configurations with the same lambda and A, which I think are physical parameters for the situation, but different, same total entropy, but they're different geometries. It's a different volume between the horizons. So I'm not going to talk about spin for the rest of the conversation, but I wanted to mention that already in the stationary or static situations, there's interesting stuff in the Schwarzschild sitter. So now let's get to what we really want to do. Some number of years ago, I mean, not that long ago. Well, I should say, I put those as main references. There's many references to this subject, and in the paper that's on the archive, we tried to list a bunch of relevant references, or we did list a bunch of relevant references, possibly not all of them, including some earlier work by Ted that predated the work that Chadburn and Gregory did. So there's been a long history of studying accretion of black holes in a situation with regular cosmic fluid and also black holes in an inflationary context. The paper by Chadburn and Gregory, what I put is a zeroth order. What they did was to consider an exponential potential, and they solved the scalar field with an exponential potential containing and a black hole in the space-time. And they say, well, let's start with the static Schwarzschild sitter potential. Lambda is changing very, very slowly. And then trace what happens as lambda evolves. And they were able to compute the increase in the black hole horizon. And they're able to write down the metric in a rather implicit form. I mean, it's there, but it's not in such a form that you can really get a lot of useful information out of the form of the metric, although they did extract the change in the pothole area. David, Ruth, and I decided to take a look at the sitter to the sitter transitions with a black hole. So the kind of potential, I mean, you can choose your favorite potential, but the kind of potential that I think things are best defined for is when you have some initial value, the potential, that's a max, and some final value, and the scalar field rolls down the potential. This is nice because you have a well-defined initial de Sitter state, and it's evolving to a well-defined final de Sitter state. So you kind of, you know where you're starting in the static state, you're ending up in a static state, and we want to see how things transition between that, hopefully connecting those two features. In this work that I did with Ruth and David, we followed using the techniques of Chadburn and Gregory, I guess what I call reference zero, we were again able to extract the change in the areas. We actually didn't even try to write down the metric throughout the range. We only solved the Einstein equations for the metric functions to the extent that had to be done so that one could compute the areas. And there were a couple of interesting things that came out. So first of all, both the change in the black hole area, by which I mean from the final state to the initial state, and the change in the cosmological area, are both proportional to the magnitude of the change in the cosmological constants. That's a delta and that's a lambda, which in terms of this picture is the initial minus the final value of the potential. That we've had more precise formulas, but I'm going to write down the precise ones later. So this was between the initial and the final state. And we also found that the first law was satisfied in going between the initial and final states. So if you take the final de Sitter metric and you take the initial de Sitter metric and you compare those two parameters, this obeyed that the sum of the temperatures or the magnitude of the surface gravities, that delta AC. Does anybody else notice there's certain conjunctions of letters that are very hard to write, like a delta, a triangle, and then an A or a lambda, because there's the chance of getting all the cross pieces in the right place, I find you're about 50% for me.
So in this transition, the temperature remains these black hole temperature and the cosmological variable temperature
remains constant. So this is a perturbative calculation. So this is, I probably should have written that down. Perturbative and slow roll. So it's a perturbative calculation. The first law, when you write down the first law, the temperatures or surface gravities that enter are that of the background. So think of those as the initial. That, I mean, that's the statement that you get out. You have kappa, kappa, and V, that's the thermodynamic volume, and this are background quantities, and this is the change in lambda, and this is the change in the areas. So that's just the way the first law works. So those are background quantities. So I don't have to address the interesting question yet about the temperatures. That's what you were.
trying to doing this calculation in my head by thinking of Ray Chatterley's equation of each horizon. And I'm thinking that, well, the area should change because you have TUU across the horizon. But TUU is proportional to G, and then when I put in the null vector, I get zero, so I don't quite see.
Okay, so it's actually a little bit different here because it's the TUU new is actually the TUU new of the scalar field. So we have this potential. So the stress energy, so say the energy density in the scalar field, has a contribution from the potential, and then I'm not swearing to the, I don't know why I put in that, the 1/2 times metric dependence. Okay. So there are both of these terms that, if you expand W out, there's a zeroth order contribution. The kinetic term, of course, is all first order. But there's also a first order term from here. So you have to include both first order terms. So it's not a lambda. But what you raise is a very interesting point, because when I saw that this result come out, I'm like, that's a bit of a surprise. So I was surprised. It's more than you have a right to get out, given this was proven for Einstein lambda, and this result is actually a different system. So I asked myself the following question. Is there a way of doing the calculation, or is it true that the first law in this form is actually satisfied at every time step? So that is to say that there's a differential version where the deltas become dA dt, dA dt, lambda dt. Is it possible that that's actually true at each time step? And that furthermore, the reason why you might think that this will reflect a metric in which you're evolving quasi-statically, whatever that means, quasi-statically, from one de Sitter to the next de Sitter. So that's what we set out to investigate.
In the case of black holes, would this be the question about the relation between the physical process, first law, and the stationary comparison?
We haven't actually gotten to that yet. Okay, so the actual computation of energy momentum fluxes of the scalar field, which could be done, because we know that stuff. I actually haven't done it yet. So I don't know.
No, but I mean the question you're posing is the same question.
Oh, no, the question I'm posing is, here's the question. All right, I'll come back. I'm working my way up to posing the question. Okay, I'm working my way up to, I think Rob.
So I'm just, you're conjecturing this law, but, are you gonna hold the surface gravity's constant because these horizons change?
I'm asking, is it true?
I know you're asking it, but is the question well posed in the sense, how can I expect the kappas to remain the same and likewise dth remain the same in this process? That's what infinitesimally I could believe it, but over a significant period.
Sorry,
I can't hear.
We don't get to impose that.
I still can't hear.
I think
he's saying they could hear.
The things that we're going to.
So they would be time dependent.
Yeah.
The things that we're going to impose is that we choose a potential and we choose an initial black hole size, and we're doing Einstein equations. So now everything's defined. Okay, so I don't get to choose anything after that. Oh, cool, I kind of lied. I am going to choose slow roll for these. For the scalar field and perturbative. So after I've committed myself to that system with those two, with those approximations, then I don't get to do any more choosing. I have to try to solve the equations.
I was thinking maybe like the temperature, you could have an equation more complicated where the temperature decapita T is in there or something. You're just not.
I think that the temperature, I think that the form of the metric that we get out is conducive for studying things like, is kappa the temperature, and how does it change in time?
Okay.
You know, but already, like just saying kappa for a time-dependent geometry, I mean that's not defined either. So you also have to come up with a definition of kappa.
Okay.
No, there's a.
I just missed something. You started off by having a capital delta, and then you're asking, could you change it to a d? What two states did the capital delta relate?
That was from the initial to final.
But where is final in this? It's in the bottom of the.
Yes.
At the bottom of the.
These two.
I see.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I guess.
Guys, I haven't even written down my metric.
That's your metric, isn't it?
No, that's not the metric. You've known that for 30 years or 40 years. No, go ahead.
So I just want to say, I mean, since that the way you started, this was the definition of your thermodynamic volume. So
wait.
Isn't it by definition correct, this what you wrote there? As long as I'm close to charge to the sitter at any time, isn't this just...
Well, that comes out from boundary conditions and Hamiltonian constraints.
Oh, because that...
No, that was the definition.
So maybe you could just... I think he's asking to clarify what you mean by thermodynamic volume.
Yeah, actually, that's the point. Yeah. So is that how it's defined, or is it just RCS, RCQ minus RGQ?
So there, the thermodynamic volume that I just erased is like the surface gravities I just erased for the background space-time, so say the initial space-time.
For the initial.
The initial. Or you could choose the final, but I like to think of it as for the initial initial space time doing perturbation theory. So you're talking about perturbative changes off that. Whether this could be true for finite changes or not, that's a different question. Okay, so let me write down the metric on this, so that'll get back to Ted's question. If we're doing inflation with no black hole, the way that we think of that, or the way that people do the calculations, is that you have some function of time, some scalar field that evolves in time in the potential W. And in this picture, as long as things are slowly rolling, blah, 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 one thinks of the cosmological constant as being, of course, it's an effective cosmological constant. But that's generated by, it's equal to the value of the potential at each time. And to the extent that things are changing slowly, this is a good way to think about it. And you can study, that's been well studied in terms of evolving different inflationary scenarios. Now, we want to talk about inflation with a black hole. And in some ways, the question that I'm asking is this still true? So can we think of is there some approximation, perturbative, slow roll, in which, in the presence of the black hole, the system evolves so that lambda is quasi-statically provided by the value of the potential at that time. And going along with that, is this still true? And that the metric quasi-statically evolves through a sequence of de Sitters. Well, let me just say, instead of writing down the metric, quasi-statically evolves through a sequence of de Sitters, we're kind of thinking of something like this. I've already said that the lambda parameter evolves according to the potential, so that would mean that also the mass parameter, something that's playing the role of the mass parameter is also evolving. This is almost out of time. I'll just give you the highlights. When you say quasi-statically in time, of course, the next question you have to ask, a favorite question for teachers of special relativity, is whose time? So, whose time? The first thing you might be tempted to try is just the Schwarzschild-Pacific time, and of course, that doesn't work. The scalar field is not going to evolve such that it acts like a clock there. You're not going to have phi only depending upon time. So the first question in terms of whose time, I know that's a, I'm a two, look at me. Metric. Whose time? So the first step is to find coordinates that, that describe static Schwarzschild sitter, but such that in those coordinates you have a solution for the scalar field that only depends upon time. And then our guess is going to be that's going to be the coordinates in which the evolution is simplest. So whose time? We choose that t is related to the usual static Schwarzschild de Sitter coordinate, such that the slow roll approximation, so that is to say phi double dot is a higher order term, so I'm just considering the overdamped scalar field solutions, such that in the slow roll approximation, there are solutions. Sorry, I draw my phis every other way. It's only the same phi. Phi of t in the background, in the static Schwarzschild sitter. And that's consistent perturbatively, because in the zeroth order space-time, phi is a constant. It's either sitting at zero or at this value of phi. So the time-dependent piece of the scalar field is already first order. So for computing that, I don't have to know what the corrected metric is. So I can actually answer this question. And that's not the only condition. We want that phi is ingoing at the black hole horizon. So it only depends upon the ingoing combination of coordinates and outgoing at the cosmological horizon. Those conditions determine this transformation, and what you get is a form for Schwarzschild de Sitter. It's gone now. Oh, but we put so much value on the things that we write, the things that we construct.
So,
what, dust to dust?
You had one more board. Than
oh, I did have one more board. Well, it's gone now. Gone now. That's what they should give in those visitor packets instead of a glossy book about Waterloo, uptown, downtown, is like how to do the board. All right, so with this coordinate transformation, this takes the form. Same function f. So f is already there, the function eta. So now I'll give these labels, SDS, and Schwarzschild de Sitter. So gamma and beta are known combinations of the original Schwarzschild-DeSitter parameters, either the RB and RC or M and lambda, but I won't write them down. So all I've done so far is transform Schwarzschild-DeSitter into these other coordinates, but this has some really nice properties that T goes to ingoing coordinate, kind of a Kruskal type coordinate at the black hole horizon, and outgoing at the Cosmo. Eta goes to 1 at the black hole and -1 at the Cosmo. Because of eta going to +/-1, the possible infinity here due to 1/f is canceled by a 0 in the numerator. So this thing actually goes to a finite number at either horizon. So the metric in this form is perfectly regular at both horizons. And this capital T, I haven't written down the transformation, capital T interpolates between ingoing and outgoing, blah, 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 as you can see from eta going from +1 to -1.
So the, can you define this T coordinate
yes.
in some nice invariant way so I don't have to think about coordinates?
The wave equation emits a slow roll solution. There's a slow roll solution for the scalar field in which phi only depends upon T.
Wait, I thought we were talking about Schwarzschild-DeSitter here.
So phi, well, this is Schwarzschild-DeSitter.
So there's no phi and no wave equation.
Oh, but you can take Schwarzschild-DeSitter and say, let's study a scalar field.
You could.
Okay, so let's. So now we're doing that, and we say, well, let's look for a solution, a slow roll kind of solution, in which it just depends upon time. So the metric depends upon both, depends upon R. So you're not going to generically get it, but we've curved our spatial slices in a way that as long as phi is evolving, it's taking time with it, or vice versa. So let me write down the form of the.
So this is, it's like exactly the solution I took for the Schwarzschild.
Probably.
But
you just you didn't wouldn't
case,
have the other side.
Yeah.
Yes. I mean, these.
One question though, why don't you just take the time coordinate to be the scalar field itself?
Well, you can think of it that way. The equation for the scalar field, you know, as long as the scalar field is evolving, you can think of that. It's -3 gamma. Phi dot is dw d phi. So I want you to think of this, once you've chosen w, then you know what phi is as a function of t. We can rewrite this as dt equals some integral d phi. So phi is known implicitly as a function of t. But you know, unless you choose it very carefully, choose the potential, it's a messy relationship. So it's more convenient to just use T as a parameter, if you will. And then, as I said, if phi stops evolving, then you know, then you're out of luck with the clock. So this is just cleaner. Now, I'll tell you what the metric ansatz is that works to show for the solution. I'll just jump to the solution at this point. So this is part of the solution. So we've done a little bit more than transform Schwarzschild-DeSitter. We actually, we found some nice, you know, for any potential you want, you have these scalar field solutions which only depend upon time. The idea is that the solution for our evolving black hole, so now it's not a lambda, it's a potential, and the scalar field's evolving in this potential. We said the idea is that things are going to look simplest, or we hope that it's simplest, it's analytically tractable in coordinates in which phi only depends upon t. So we've gone to those coordinates for the metric. And what I first tried is what would be really nice is if you could just make the parameters, what start as parameters, m and lambda, into functions of time, and let the Einstein equations determine how those evolve in time, where you also want there's too many threes. I see that's one another thing I get confused with. There's a three in this. Okay, with lambda of t equal to the potential. My point of view in trying to find a solution is if the solution doesn't have the quasi-static features that I'm looking for, then it's not really worth it solved. So we started out by saying lambda should be the potential. So this was the first thing I tried, and it didn't work. So I'm going to call that F quasi-static. And it's quasi-static because it has the same form as the Schwarzschild function, which is by some miracle, it's right next to it on the board, but where we've elevated these to functions of time and we seek to solve for their behavior. And then I needed what one could nicely call an accommodation factor. Less nicely, you could call it a fudge factor. This extra piece is needed to find this. It is, and Ada. Yes, I have to find some other place to write that down.
There is one more board down there.
Yes. Oh, this one goes up.
Yes.
But then it'll be hidden in any case. Are you saying I can save erasing time?
Yes.
Okay. This board is nicer. Of course, the first thing I tried for Ada was a similar quasi-static thing in which the gamma and beta are elevated to functions of time. And it didn't work. And what did work is solution. Okay, so I'm going to show you the rest of the solution.
Up to order, neglect in terms of second order.
So this is perturbation theory. So anything I've called delta A to delta F or an F quasi-static, up there is an M of T. So the deviations of M from a constant will keep the first order contributions
based
there.
A linearized solution, scalar and metric off of the Schwarzschild considered.
Yes.
But beta and gamma don't become functions of time in the Ada SDS.
No, they don't.
But they do for the F.
They do. So
is this an article of the route you took? I mean, you choose F first and then try to compare beta? Because given that you said beta is just a function of the lambda n, and you're taking the opposite route, that would be an Ada of T and R with a small fudge factor, and you're going to change completely.
No, it's. It's more embedded than that because when you make these ansatz, and I'm not going to write down all the, well, there's actually not that many equations, so it depends if someone wants me to write them down or not. The system collapses, but it's already the end of the talk. That by making an ansatz like this, the good feature of an ansatz like M of T and lambda T is you know there's part of the Einstein equation operator that gives you the solution for Schwarzschild the sitter. So that is to say, when it's only R derivatives, when it's only the R derivatives, the Einstein operator acting on this quasi-static ansatz, that's going to give you lambda, because you already know that's how it works. So that's the good part, and you make use of that. The bad part is you've committed yourself to the R dependence of your time-dependent piece. So powers of R either match or they don't. Okay. So I promised that if we couldn't have lambda approximately equal to W, I'm not interested in the solution. The other thing I'm not interested in the solution is that in the end, the roots, so M and lambda are related to the roots of, say, of the function F in a certain way in the background. if we don't have that same relation, okay, if we can't find the horizons, then again, this is not what I'm looking for, because part of the picture is that the horizons evolve quasi-statically or in some way that I can compute. I really want this to be Schwarzschild de Sitter evolving in time.
But how are you defining the horizons?
Okay. That part I'm definitely not going to be able to get completely to. And I had a major panic attack when I saw that this you needed this to get the horizons. But even with this non-symmetrical aspect, the horizons actually still, the horizons end up being at the place where they're supposed to be. Different kinds. So let me just write down the answer. And then.
But just to push the point, so, I mean, if you, you know, modified the Schwarzschild, so the first one in eta, you could have decided to make gamma and beta time dependent and redefine delta eta to make that true, right? So there's a degeneracy of what you call one.
Well, there is, but when you write down the equations, there's kind of, I mean, that's fine. But there's like things that cancel from the zeroth order, and then you have everything accumulated. I'll write down the solutions, and you know, you can tell me what you, if you want to rename things. So the less interesting terms, and I'll be able to justify that these are actually less interesting, the delta F, or accommodation factor, let me say something about these accommodation factors. The delta F, which I really hope wouldn't appear, but it does, the delta F is proportional to phi dot squared. And I have a function of integration, I've chosen that delta F equals zero. I've chosen my lower limit to be the black hole. This is in the background, so I know what I mean, the black hole radius in the black background. So delta F is zero at the background black hole radius. It's not zero at the cosmological horizon radius. So come back to that. And you have this form for F quasi-static where that part, in what seems to me to be a non-trivial way, actually works. So the Einstein equations, do the powers of R turn out to work out, which was advertised as seems to me non-trivial. You can computing the rate of growth d by dt of the m parameter and lambda, which integrating this gives lambda equals w of phi using the slow roll equation, and that's of course what we want. The last ingredient is what about the zeros of capital F? And since I'm already, oh gosh, I didn't even tell you how the formulas are. Oh well. Surprisingly to me, the combination that you choose for eta, when you put in the zeroth and the first order correction, you still find that the combination eta equal to the, that goes to one at the black hole horizon. And in fact, one minus eta goes to a constant at the black hole horizon, R minus RV of T, where I'm defining RB of T and RC of T to be the, by the same relations, by the background relations, if you take our M and lambda of T and use the Schwarzschild de Sitter, oh, that doesn't go up. Use the Schwarzschild de Sitter relations, I'm defining the time-dependent radii to be that. And these are actually zeros, first of all, consider the black hole horizon. It's a zero of R minus, R, this goes like R minus RB, which you need so that when you have expressions in the metric and here, so that 1 minus eta squared over F, it doesn't blow up. Well, it's not important, that's the background, but in the metric, it's important here that the metric doesn't blow up at the horizon, and that's actually true to first order, even though it didn't look like it was going to be true. So if you take the kind of the quasi-static solutions, the quasi-static definitions for the black hole radii, then near the horizon, this goes to, this term goes to zero, and you still have plus two dt dr times some constant, not constant, time-dependent function. These depend on. The last thing I'm going to put on the board, I won't be offended if anybody leaves because I know this is over, is I wanted to give you the formula for the growth of the black holes. That was the real output. So I'm doing fast and dirty to advertise that you can check that the zeros of the perturbed function f are where they should be in terms of a quasi-static relationship with m and lambda. What that means is that you can take these, this one goes up, these relations you can translate into for either the horizon radii, what's the rate of growth of the horizon coordinate and hence the area. So you can get RH dot, and I'll just write it in terms of the area. I guess I don't have the sheet. Okay, RH dot is proportional to itself over the surface gravity times phi dot squared. Because of this 1 over the surface gravity, when you assemble this, kappa times the area that, as was suggested by the previous calculation, where we just did the initial to the final, that the first law is satisfied in this differential step, the differential sense. And you can integrate this to get the change in the areas. I'll just write down the change in the black hole area. Oh, I can write them both down. The change in the horizon area is proportional to the original horizon area divided by its surface gravity. There's the ratio of the thermodynamic volume to the total area, and then times the change in the potential, which, since the potential is decreasing, the initial minus W of phi is a positive. So this gives the change in the area at time t.
This is for both horizons.
For both, where h is for horizon. If you, now this formula as it sits is kind of highly redundant because like I said, there's only two background parameters and there's all those geometrical variables. For the black hole, if you write down the fractional change in the black hole area, that goes like delta lambda over lambda times, if the black hole is really small, then this is parametrically small. So what do I mean? So this is small compared to in the units of the original cosmological constant. And this is of order one, well, it's actually a quarter, if the black hole is large. So the kind of the output is for medium to large size black holes, delta A over A is proportional to delta lambda over lambda, and there's not much, it's small if the black hole is very small. If you look at the cosmological horizon, again, if the black hole is very small, it changes pretty much the same as if you had no black hole there. But if the black hole is small, is medium to large, then the change can be decreased by as much of a factor of a third. Multiplied by a third, which means it's down by a factor of two-thirds. So in terms of future work, I think two of the very interesting directions is to see if you can understand if the time-dependent version of kappa is a temperature. And also in practical sense is to calculate the spectrum of perturbations and inflation in the presence of a black hole. Because the output for the change in the areas is if the black hole is, you know, kind of a tenth the radius of the cosmological horizon, then you get a significant effect on the volume that's between those two horizons. Is that a feature that one can calculate? Is it a feature one can look for? Like, I'm really sorry. But that was all your fault because you were asking this question. I know it's. I'm happy to.
Okay. So when you take your stereo field, you're going to only on big T. So I'm wondering whether that's an assumption or because I would expect the stereo field to depend on two variables, and that the spatial variation would become more and more important as you get closer.
So that's a great question. So we use this choice of coordinates to find a solution, and you know, even though I rushed you that, I think it's correct. And the idea again was that finding a solution dealing with the Einstein equations, even though it was perturbative, there's a lot of the terms, that dealing with that would be simplest in coordinates in which phi depends upon t. That was the guess. That facilitated finding a solution. It doesn't facilitate answering what we expect, that if you're looking at the energy density, so you have a scalar field, and you expect it accretes the area the black hole is growing. It's growing because scalar field stuff is going into it. So it doesn't capture our other expectation that closer to the black hole stuff should be more dense and further away. And then at some point you expect it, then it's going the other direction. It's going with the cosmological expansion. So one of the things to do is to transform to a different set of coordinates, which I think would be more like McVitie-ish coordinates, in which, or any other set of coordinates, you're going to find position dependence of the energy density. So these ones are kind of either special or perverse in that respect. And you have to think, well, what are the preferred, more cosmological-like coordinates that will show the physics of higher density near the black hole and joining the cosmological expansion further out? You know, again, it's like whose time? Which point of view is the right?
But when you have to write the data, it's your shift. Until
well, this shows that correctly captures the flux. But if you compute, if you want to say, well, how does the energy density vary across the spatial slice? Well, in these coordinates, it doesn't. Because the final depends upon time, and the energy density just depends upon the time derivative of phi squared and the potential. So it doesn't vary. So, okay, well, that's how it is, but that's because you've kind of distorted your spatial slices to go surfaces of constant phi. So I'm just saying, if you want to answer a question of like, where's it densest, then it's like, well, where is it densest from whose point of view? So I'm open to suggestions from whose point of view is a good point of view to look at to answer that question, but I was kind of starting to look at a more McVitie-ish type slicing, which also might be good for looking at the larger black holes.
I like the idea of using the scalar field itself as the time.
It might, you know, you could, one could go through the equations and wherever you see df dt, write that as df d phi, d phi dt, and see if that simplifies the equation.
It's kind of degenerative.
So I think, in view of time, I think we should probably delay questions to lunch. And, I have one quick question, though. Is
it? Oh, we couldn't even
tell.
Okay.
Sure, we can get about it. Okay. So let's ask Jenny again.